Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week and I hope the football didn't add to your grieving, and I hope that if you're listening in England you are coping with the level of weather chat we're having to do at the moment, because guys, it is really hot here. Thank you so much for listening. If you do enjoy the show, please do rate and review us on iTunes. I know every podcast asks you to do that, but it does genuinely help other people find the show. And if you really enjoy it, why not subscribe, and then you will not miss an episode, I promise. And if you really, really, really enjoy it, why not come and see us live? What could be better than people chatting about death in a cheery manner in front of your face? Because we're going to be at the London Podcast Festival on September the 15th. I'm going to be joined by some brilliant guests, No Such Thing as a Fish's Andrew Hunter-Murray and Throwing Shade's Erin Gibson. Tickets are available now from the King's Place website, so head there for more information on that show and the whole festival. This week I'm talking to comedian Robin Clifan. Robin has appeared on BBC Radio 4's The Now Show and Newsjack. He's written for Vice and The Independent, and he's also the host of The Moth's Story Slam. Robin came in to talk to me about his mum, who died 18 months ago of an extremely rare blood cancer. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with comedian and writer Robin Clifham. Hello.
Hi.
Robin, I always talk about people's names, but I actually know something about your name, which I find really interesting. Am I allowed to say?
Yeah.
Is this true? I've heard this because you know members of Ostentatious more intimately, I was going to say, but that sounded
more
really weird.
Intimately.
Like you went to uni with them and they told me that Clifham is a made-up surname. Is that right?
Yeah, it is.
That your parents made up?
They did.
I love that. So what were the other two surnames? Because that's what I don't think they've given me that piece of information.
Well, there's one other person with that surname who's my twin sister, Amy.
Wow.
So Amy Clifham.
Yeah.
And then there's my mum and dad, my dad Clive and my mum Anne. So Clive and Anne. Clivan. That's how
so
we got there.
So it wasn't even their surnames?
No, they've got different surnames and not the same surname as each other, yeah.
I thought they'd put their surnames together.
No, they put their first names together.
Wow.
Clivan's slightly better than Anne Cliff, which...
Clifan to me sounds so Welsh. Clifan.
Yeah, well, you've just hit on two themes that are the exact themes that my mum wanted you to hit on when...
Oh, great.
Talking about my name.
She wanted people to think you're Welsh.
She wanted people to think I was Welsh, and I think she wanted to do something that wasn't particularly like heteronormative.
Oh.
I think she wanted to do something that was a bit radical, and
she
was coming from that kind of activist background of
sexual
politics. So it is spelt the Welsh way. It is spelt C-L-Y-F-A-N, so people
think
ages, I'm Welsh.
I thought you were Welsh, and I remember thinking...
Well, my mum, it was.
Yeah, but I remember thinking, oh, that's an unusual... I've not heard that Welsh name before. Like Clifan. But it just sounds Welsh, doesn't it? Clifan.
It does sound Welsh, but some Welsh people say that maybe they've spelt it wrong, or it's... it's a little bit messy, but...
Never messy.
The intention was to... and I asked my mum once, actually, I said, why did you want people to... think I was Welsh, and she said, just in case I forgot. So she wanted me, I think it was for me, to remind me that
she was Welsh.
She was Welsh and I'm a bit Welsh.
So you're the same as me, because I'm only half Welsh. It's only my dad's side. I know, but I've got the Welshest name possible.
You know, my mum's surname was Lloyd.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Martha.
Hello.
Intense.
She's called Anne Lloyd.
She's called Anne Lloyd, yeah.
She's my great aunt. Was Anne Lloyd.
Oh,
I mean, that's
God.
Probably not that like unusual in Wales.
Suddenly, who do you think you are?
Well, she was a Lloyd. Oh my God, that's
Lloyd.
Amazing.
But Lloyd wasn't her maiden name. She was married before she met my dad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, so I know that's a bit deflated.
Yeah. What was her maiden name?
Coleman.
Coleman.
Irish, solid Irish name.
Oh, okay. God, I mean, this is. And we found out you're related to King William
I. So, yay!
That's always what you're looking for. And who do you think you are? So, Robin, who are we remembering today?
We are remembering my mum.
Your mum. So, how old were you when your mum died? Was it recently?
Or? Yeah, I mean, I was 32.
Okay, so how many...
Or was I 31? It was 18 months ago.
Oh,
I've just turned 33, yeah, so it was recently.
Really recent.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise. Wow.
Yeah.
So what happened? What did she die of?
She died of a very rare form of leukaemia.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
The rare ones.
One of those... Cheeky, rare
ones.
Fuck off.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the rare one. Let's start. So was she ill for a while or what? Like, how did the diagnosis come about?
It's funny because when people ask me that, I often say she was ill for 2 or 3 years, but I've realised I was just remembering it wrong.
Yeah.
She was actually only ill for 14 months.
Yeah.
Maybe slightly longer, 15 months. Yeah.
But it does get blurred, doesn't it? Everything
does.
Gets blurred.
Yeah. Because it was quite rare, there was quite a the prognosis was quite ambiguous.
Right.
They kind of said it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years, it could be 2 years.
Oh my God!
And
what was the name of it? If you don't mind me, because I'm sure somebody.
Yeah. What was the name of it? It was atypical acute myeloid.
Wow.
With a dyspraxic element. Oh, God.
Oh, my God, that sounds
that's
so
maybe
technical.
I think I probably got that wrong and said the word dyspraxic and just not what I mean.
Somebody will tweet us and tell us what you did mean. So, yeah.
That's someone who has problem judging
like
distances,
movement.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's like,
or movement. Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, well.
Yeah, you got the main bit.
I got the main bit. We'll go with the leukaemia bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was hard because it was, there were... trying to understand the different elements of it was, yeah.
Yeah, complicated.
Complex.
So what happened, first of all, was she just went to the doctors and she was not feeling great? Or, like, when did you become aware of, like, oh, this is something a bit more serious?
I was in Greece with my then-girlfriend Emily, and my Mum had gone to the doctor because she was feeling tired. And she had, they took her blood and she had quite a very high white blood cell count, I think. And then it became quite urgent. I'm trying to think back to this now. And then we went to the hospital. I think it then became a leukemia that seemed more, for want of a better word, mainstream and common, which was more treatable. I think drugs for blood cancers have improved significantly over the last 20 or 30 years, and so a lot of them can be managed. But it then became apparent that she had a rare condition, and without a particular chromosome that would have made treatment easier. Wow. And that's when the prognosis was always ambiguous, but it became more apparent that it was more difficult to manage. And actually, yeah, God, I suppose this is the point, but it takes it all back now.
Yeah.
Then it was trying to, I think about how to talk to the right person, because I actually found the paper that they were, because it was such a rare atypical condition, I realised they were giving the prognosis off this one paper, which had been published in on Atypical.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the name again because I'm going to get it wrong. But
it's so rare that it's like there wasn't even a kind of a usual route to deal with it.
Yeah, there wasn't the research to be able to give. I suppose it's always very difficult, if you ask anyone in a medical profession to give a prognosis, because that's very difficult to be pinned down to any date. But that's how it began. And we went to go see an expert, and then I think there was an option of having a bone marrow stem cell transplant, but that I think we decided that was too risky.
So then what, in that sort of 14 months of her being ill, did she sort of just steadily get a bit more weak, or was she in hospital? Like, did you kind of have a bit of normal life? Because it's that weird bit with diagnosis where it's like, right, well, once you know it, you can't just sit around and cry constantly, so you're sort of like, well, what should we do, you know?
That's an interesting question. There were moments of health, like where she was feeling better, where we did do things she wanted to do, like she always wanted to go to the seaside and go to Whitby in particular and Scarborough. So we did things like that she wanted to do. And there were moments when she was in hospital and it looked like, you know, you have that moment where it looks like she would die and then she rallies again.
Yeah.
And I think everyone's relationship to her mortality within the family was slightly running at different paces, I think, as is always the case.
God, yeah, grief. That's a really good way of putting it.
And hers in particular as well.
Yeah.
I think she had a very... she went through a phase of definitely wanting to fight it and wanting me to be her ally in that, which I spent a long time trying to do research with conventional and very unconventional medicine and all those kind of things that she wanted to engage with.
Well, I mean, my dad did some...
Did he?
Yeah. My dad did, like, Chinese herbs and, like, I mean, we knew lots of people. So it'd be like, oh, I'm going to see Gaia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's her name. Lovely Gaia, actually, really nice. For some light therapy, you know, stuff like that. And I remember coming up the stairs and like my dad just lying down and like, you know, Gaia just holding her hand. And that was very normal as a child that somebody would be doing a bit of healing somewhere. So that sort of thing. Yeah. What did you get into?
Well, what she got into, she went to see someone who she said was a spiritual healer. I think what happened for my mum was she was being given such bad news by conventional medicine, and she always had a slight a very anti-establishment streak to her, very radical politics, so there was something in her that wanted to be contrary to an establishment view. And also I think the truth of it was she wasn't being given any hope by them, so she just went to a place that was giving her hope, and she went to someone who she just described as a spiritual healer. What I could tell, she just kind of lay on a bed while someone moved their hands.
Yeah, they love doing that.
Maybe lit some incense.
Yeah, a lot of candles and moving hands. But I suppose it's... I don't have a problem with it. I suppose, again, that's what's interesting about the two schools, like you say, of like, it'd be nice if there was a bit of a meeting in the middle. Because the alternative offers like so much hope that sometimes you're like, guys, fucking come on, like some facts would be good here.
Yeah.
And then the medical is so like, this is it, that's nothing. We're not telling you any, like,
you're going to die.
You think, yeah. Well, really what people seek in alternative so much is a space to just, like, oh, can I just have someone listen to me?
Yeah, exactly.
And have someone be like, oh, that sounds bad, rather than like, well, that's all we can do.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's so hard, isn't it? I mean, because for me, the thing that I did really appreciate about the NHS was that she, you know, they're always very proportionate with the evidence. They never overstated what they knew, but there's just not enough time to give someone the care that they need.
Yeah.
And I think my mum made a decision. She explicitly said to me, she said, there's no such thing as, you know, false hope. There's only hope. So she made a decision to go places that she knew would give her that. And
she's fair enough.
Yeah, she's fair enough.
Like, I don't, again, my dad was,
what did he do? Did he keep with the alternative medicine thing when he was sick?
Yeah. So, yeah, they were very alternative anyway. And then when he was sick, it was like, again, I guess because they had those friends. So it was like, and again, it was in our world. So it was like, yeah, obviously he's also taking Chinese herbs and going to Reiki and, you know, having like aura cleansing, like, obvs. Like, what else? And so, yeah, lots of people came around and like offered their services. And so I remember the Chinese herbs the most because they fucking stank. Oh my God.
Ooh,
and the liquid, I remember him drinking it and being like, but I guess the chemo was making him so sick. So it's like, well,
do you think it...
Why not?
Do you think it helped him?
I don't know. I think we still don't understand what your mum was talking about, the power of hope. I think we still don't really understand what that might mean to someone who knows they're dying. So I think it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably helped him mentally to think, I'm doing something, to feel in control in a situation he wasn't in control of. I think people coming around and giving, inverted commas, healing was probably quite healing in that you lie there, you breathe, you're calm, someone is kind to you. Like, I'm sure that wasn't negative. Whether you could say, it shrank his tumour. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it did. But yeah, I think that's what I mean, that, you know, both sides could learn from the other, I always say. I'm not someone who'd ever be like, oh, all of it's bullshit. I do think, as much as you can say there's medical doctors who their bedside manner is actually damaging the way they tell that news, you can also say, yes, there's homeopathists who are peddling bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, everybody could improve.
Yeah.
So, I do think it, I definitely think it helped him psychologically to feel like he was doing something.
Yeah.
Because I suppose when you're waiting for treatments and, you know, he had chemo, and they were very much like, oh, yes, you should do it. But my mum always swears, like, we shouldn't have done it. It was too late. And it made him so ill. So I think to do something that wasn't, you know, as awful as the chemo must have felt useful, maybe.
And I suppose that's where the kind of the hope thing can become a bit dangerous, because you can keep fighting in a way that can be just so exhausting.
Yeah, my dad definitely kept fighting. And I remember in the week before he died, I think, he was like, oh, I mean, this was just my dad, but like, he was in the bed in the hospital and like my mum was one side, I was the other. And he was like, right, get a pen and paper out. Let's get planning what we're going to do next week and the trip we're going to take. I remember like me and my mum being like, you clearly aren't going anywhere. This is, and that's when it's painful. That's when you want to be like, my mum found it very difficult to get him to talk about like what he wanted for his funeral or what he, any plans. Cause he was just like, no, we're going to beat this. When he was like, okay, we're definitely not.
And was there ever a moment of acknowledgement with him and you?
Not with me. I mean, I was 15.
Yeah.
So my mum said she would like, we've talked about it actually. She said like she would like force him. She'd be like, right, come on, you've got to tell me. Like, what do you want to do? Where do you want your ashes scattered? And she said he would just like, you know, they obviously knew each other well. She'd say stuff to shut her up. Like, oh, just put them anywhere or take him to Wales, take him to Fintorn, like this weird hippie place they used to go to. But she said she always felt like, oh, it was just to end the conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, we never had a moment where he acknowledged he was dying. And I...
Did you want that?
Yeah, I would have. I would have liked that. What about you? Did you ever get that with your mum where it was like, okay, I'm talking to you as someone who knows they're dying?
Yeah, I tried.
Yeah.
So many times.
Oh, it's so hard, isn't it?
Macmillan, what can really help, I find sometimes, is someone coming in from the outside of the family, because it's such a pressure cooker and it never feels like there's enough space for anyone to grieve, because you're already grieving when someone's terminally ill. And a Miller nurse came in, and my mum had a very kooky house, and she was sat on her sofa surrounded by her books. And the nurse just kind of looked at her and went, "You don't look well, Anne." And there was, I think, a moment of truth and recognition. And after that, I tried to talk to my mum. And she said, she was like, "I'm in denial."
Mm.
And I know I'm in denial. And she made a decision to be in denial.
Be in denial.
And so from that, and that point, she'd say, "Why would I talk about my death? You know, there's nothing more boring." But then before she went into a hospice, and before she did that, she spent about an hour giving me and my sister just very prescriptive advice.
Oh, really? Okay,
that was of just like mad stuff of like, "Robin, this is what you should wear on Friday, and you should go out with someone who's very tall banjo player, and Amy, you should do this." And I was like, okay. I almost had to go to a stage with my mum. I was like, "Please don't give out advice this specific, because we're going to feel really crap when we can't do it.
If we don't do it." Oh my God.
So there were definitely acknowledgements from her.
Yeah. And,
but for a lot of the time, she made a decision not to talk about it.
It's really hard, I think, as the child. I didn't really, at the time, I didn't have the words. So I was like, "Well, okay, whatever." But as a 30-something, I now feel like, I've had to forgive him, because I've definitely had that moment where I thought, "Why didn't you fucking talk to me? Because you knew you were dying." But also then when you flip it around and you go, "Oh, they're dying. They don't have the words. They don't know how to say to their children, 'I'm not going to,' because they don't." My dad really didn't want to die in that way. Like, he really didn't. He was like not happy about it. He was like pissed off.
Yeah.
And so I've had to, it's taken a lot of time to kind of go, "It's not your fault." Like, I think you can feel the anger of them not acknowledging it, but accept that they weren't doing it maliciously, and there's nothing you could do.
And that's because I think when someone's dying, you have a lot of anger at that person.
Oh, God, so much anger.
Because, I mean, firstly, how dare they die?
How dare they fucking die?
What the fuck are you doing?
Like, what the... I need you. What are you doing? Yeah. Yo, I was furious. It's the most annoying thing he's ever done.
It's so annoying.
That's what I can say.
It's like, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for them to make it fair either.
Yeah.
You've got to do that on your own.
Exactly.
But then also I think there's that feeling of, I think you forget sometimes that they're dying.
Yes.
And the enormity of staring into the great unknown.
Yeah.
And I found with my mum and a good friend before that, family friend Jerry died, and with him there were kind of acknowledgements of what, and with my mum as well, the losses were kind of more specific, tangible ones, because death is such an enormous thing.
Yeah.
So it was a really significant moment when it just became apparent that my mum wouldn't be able to go outside anymore, or she wouldn't be able to go to the seaside, or your world just gets smaller like that.
Yeah.
And I think then the grief or the moments of acknowledgement of loss become relatable, and when they're specific, because who knows what death is. It's just those little specific things where it's like, I don't think my mum's ever going to go outside. She's going to look at that tree, and her world's going to get smaller. I think that was those kind of realizations, or the last time we had this pizza that she really liked.
Yeah,
do you know?
Yeah.
Those specific things, though, where there's acknowledgement. Yeah,
but you're right, because it's so massive. When you do find something to hook it onto, it's like,
exactly.
Okay, it's the last this. It's the last this.
Yeah.
And you keep, and like you said, they get, you just start counting them down.
And
seeing them get smaller and smaller. And that smaller thing's really interesting, because it does, you know, when they're ill, they're going to hospital and you go and talk to people. And then eventually you go just to one hospital, and then you're just in one room. And the nurses start to be the same, you know, nurses at the end.
Yeah.
Like, everything is just those people. And you've gone from this sort of very medical, like, "Oh, we're going here, we're doing this, and these people," to just like, "Nah, these three guys have got it, because there's not much else to do now."
Yeah.
Which, is really, it's such a strange process. So, so then your mum is, so she's being treated. Is she having treatment?
She was managed.
So it became
apparent that, you know, she couldn't be cured.
Right.
It was a case of managing it with very... I mean, I've already messed up what she had, but with us, I won't go into the drugs, but very...
no, don't worry. You're not a doctor, that's okay.
I'm not a doctor, guys. But, that's a lot of great situations start with that, don't they? But I'm going to have a go.
This is what I think
this
she should
take. With this here spatula and these pills. She was managed with very, quite rudimentary generic drugs that were just weren't specific to her condition. So it was just about making sure there was a balance between her red blood cells and her white blood cells. And, you know, she'd have good weeks and bad weeks. And when the weeks were good, she'd feel optimistic and happy. And I think for her, talking about the alternative medicine thing, she'd try and find explanations as to why a week had been good or a week had been bad,
logic.
Which was like, oh, that's because I had a stressful experience because I watched that, because somebody, I saw someone kick a cat or, you know, or something about that she could relate to that was about giving a logic to the chaos of...
Wait, that's the problem, is it? It's chaos and there's no control. And they're being told there's a thing that doesn't make sense inside you. I can't imagine how that, what that does to your, capacity for understanding the world. So, then you do start, it's a bit like superstitions, isn't it? Like, you know, when you get a bit like, oh, I stepped on three drains, that's why that boy dumped me.
Yeah,
and then you're like,
to
touch
every railing.
Yeah, I had Reiki, so that's why I'm feeling good.
Throw this brick through a window.
Yeah, because you're just looking for something to hook things onto, because what you're doing, especially with your mum, I guess, having such a rare condition, that must have been really... You know, there's no rule book, is there? There's not like, here's these other people and they had this and they went through this. So
there was no one else who'd had it. They hadn't seen it before in the hospital. Hadn't seen it before in Leeds, which was the bigger hospital with the experts in it. They hadn't seen it either. And
Jesus.
I spent some time trying to find someone who might have seen the condition, and the only people we could really contact was someone who'd met someone at an international conference, but there was just no research in it. And so I tried to find out about clinical trials and all those things that you try and cling on to, but that's such a risk. I mean, obviously, I think there's an idea, as a layperson, you know, ignorant layperson like myself, there's sometimes an idea that a medicine is an exact science, but you know, it's an art with is a science, but there's that risk management in it where it gets very difficult, because there was a drug in America that you know we thought about flying her over to America and giving her this thing that had a 30% chance, but you take I think I am, though. I don't know. I think because she put a lot of responsibility on me specifically to look into that, but I did at the time make a decision just to be totally exhaustive with it, so that when it came to the point afterwards, I really went for it, and I don't think there was... The sad truth is I don't think there was anything.
Yes, you really...
I really looked. Although it's kind of suspicious that I now can't remember what she had.
Sure, I looked, guys.
Sure, I'm looking. La, 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 la.
One Google.
Oh, I'm so tired. Better relax.
Turns out there's nothing here. Why do you think your mum... what you're saying, did she put more of that on you than she did your sister?
Yes.
Or do you know why? Did you ever speak to her about that? Did you?
I don't know. She put different pressures on my sister
that were
equally as difficult. Mm. She asked my sister to care for her in a way, I think because she was a woman, in terms of like intimacy, in a way that she didn't ask me.
Yeah.
But I think my mum always... So going back to the name.
Yeah.
So my mum was a very vociferous feminist scientist and a working class Welsh woman who I think she saw me as slightly loud, sometimes a bit annoying Englishman. But that could be, and I think she found in a way, she found that was annoying, but I think she felt like she wanted me to handle things for her. Mm. I don't know, there's a way in which she put responsibility. She thought I was just good at making a fuss and going off at doing stuff. So I think she just...
Perhaps she liked having
those conversations with me, I think.
Perhaps she understood the patriarchy. It's like...
Utilise the patriarchy.
Send a man in and I might get some
that's
answers.
That's bad, isn't it? That's a conflict for me. Trying to utilise my oppressive skills to help my vociferous feminist mother.
No, you're an inside...
There lies
inside,
a conflict.
Yeah,
I'm an inside,
inside
agent.
Cell. Yeah, exactly.
It's wicked. That's
as long as
all
you know,
I wanted.
You know what you're doing. You're playing the game, but you know what you're doing. That's totally fine.
That's all I wanted was... a woman to tell me I knew what I was doing in the patriarchy.
I have to offer I have done that before. I've sent my husband in to do things.
Really?
Is that terribly unfeminist? Only when it's like I don't have the time to challenge this person.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in medical situations where you're like, Jesus, can, like, there's bigger things here. So if you're going to talk to my tall white husband quicker and more, like, what's the word? More eloquently than you are me, great, talk to him, because I know he's a good feminist. He'll come back and explain it to me. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine to be an inside agent occasionally. An ally, as I say. But yeah, so when you spoke to her about that, did she... Yeah, what did she say? Did you say, this is a lot for me to deal with, or...?
It came out in lots of ways. She'd sometimes be excited and be like, we're going to do it, Robin. We're going to find out all these... We're gonna beat this.
Wow.
And she was so thorough. She made, like, pages, documents that were hundreds of pages of long,
wow,
with all kinds of research, with how, you know, mung beans and charcoal and all these different things could be used, dandelions. And so she was very thorough. And so she talked to me, and there were those moments of optimism. There were moments when she found... She was so sensitive that she found any form of disagreement or behaviour from me very upsetting.
Yeah.
And that was really difficult, because she'd really get upset with me about it and I'd feel horrific.
Yeah.
And then there were moments when that came... There were tensions, really. There was some alternative therapist that she was... or naturopath that she was using, who I think it transpired, it became apparent to me that I think he was really overstating what he knew in a way that was really dangerous, actually.
Yeah.
And he was a very mild-mannered Canadian, so I think she initially trusted him, and I was a loud, shouty man arguing with him. So I think she was like, oh, Robin, you're just being big, obnoxious Robin.
You're like, no, actually, this arsehole.
No, I actually think he's an arsehole.
Yeah.
And we got over that. But
that's the thing with the alternative. I completely agree, because when you meet a lot of these alternative people, like people in that world, and I'm not, you know, there's some amazing, genuine angels out there who are incredible at healing, and then there's some fucking charlatans.
Oh, yeah.
But they all, there's that sort of voice.
The voice, yeah.
That voice of, hi, I'm here to heal you. And it's hard sometimes. I definitely had, like, some of my weird dad's friends that I'd be like, I don't like this one. Like, this one is definitely after your 60 quid, and that's...
Yeah.
Which, of course, they're humans. They're not angels, you know. Just because there are 1 in 10 are literally, like, these amazing healing people who want nothing but to heal the world.
Yeah.
There are some bastards out there.
Real bastards.
Real freaking...
I mean, I didn't like that guy. I think
you feel more betrayed as well, don't you? Because you're like, you're supposed to be on the fucking healing side,
you
know?
Yeah, it's like you... Bell end.
Yeah, you're not on the medical side just, like, stealing hope. You're supposed to be, like, doing this for healing.
Yeah.
Which is unfair on doctors who are doing it just for healing and don't get paid properly.
No, indeed.
But when you grow up with alternative therapies, they do teach you that those people are bad, don't they?
I mean, that is a problem.
Yeah.
I think, because, I mean, that is one of the things that actually, I think, became a problem with this guy, was that he was actually encouraging her to, you know, distrust her oncologist. And that was to a point where I was like, okay, mate, you can...
Yeah.
You're £150 an hour, can stick it up your bum.
Fuck off, yeah. That's when I get angry, because I'm like, look, I would never... If you want to do alternative therapies, yeah, do them. Great, great, great. Also, take these other drugs.
Yeah.
Like, take the drugs that, you know, really do... I'm like, do everything. But when there is that... I know. People will tell me they healed themselves with dandelions, but not everyone does.
It was difficult because, I mean, I won't go into too much detail, but I ended up doing things like, he wanted to do something that he, which was medical, but was like a thing called a chemosensitivity test, where you have your blood tested in a lab to see how it responds to certain chemotherapies.
Right.
And alternative therapies, which I think could be useful, but is part of a much bigger picture and very different to how your body responds when it's in the body.
Yeah, yeah.
But he really overstated that. So I think there was the point that I lost it was, this is quite gruesome. I was like, you know, trying to send vials of my mother's blood in, like, cold packaging to Germany to get tested in this thing that I think he was really being quite dishonest about. And at that point I thought, I hate this man so much. I want to go to his house and set fire to everything. Which I didn't do, as I've told the police.
But it's so hard because your parent is dying and you want to help.
Yeah.
And then you don't know who to believe. And the trouble is, like you said, the biggest, what it always comes down to is no one fucking knows.
No one knows,
especially with something that rare. Yeah. Like, I think when you've got, you know, my dad had pancreatic cancer, which, you know, isn't that rare, but it's sort of seen as quite rare because it's, anyway, it's always secondary. But, like, I can't imagine how you must have felt when you're dealing, like, you don't even have, like, a room full of, well, all these people have this leukemia, like, all of us, and that person can tell you, well, we tried this. When you don't have that, of course you're grasping at straws, aren't you?
Yeah.
And then you are vulnerable, and it is easy for some arsehole to make you send blood to Germany and make you pay for it. Like, you're vulnerable at that point. And the way, I think that's interesting, you know. I wonder if, even though your mum found it distressing, don't you think it's interesting she put the loud Englishman in charge? Who was going to say this is bullshit eventually? Like, she must have known you were like
a bit.
Perhaps she thought
bit,
you.
Yes.
Perhaps she thought you would protect her somewhere in her brain.
And she did think I was good at those kind of things.
Yeah.
That is obviously she thought I was competent.
Yeah, but somewhere in her brain, she must have known that you weren't going to just go along with everything.
Oh yeah, she absolutely trusted me on that.
Yeah.
I think she found certain things difficult, but she absolutely trusted me on that. And also, really great intimate moments of. I mean, and that's about my relationship with my mum, which is that we disagreed. She had such powerful convictions, politically and personally as well. But I could talk to her about them, and it would take a long time, but she would listen, and I think we really trusted each other on that. And I think from that came, we could have discussions about these things, and it was good to have a project with her to be engaging in something that was proactive.
Yeah.
And as much as that led to a difficult place, it was like we had a task that was, and you know, my dad and my sister helped just as much, if not more than me, in similar and different ways. So, and Scott, my dad's partner, who was also hugely involved. So there were lots of people there. It wasn't
but
just
that's,
me.
But, I mean, that's,
but, yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, I don't know, the thing with death of like, parents don't always do what you want them to do. Like, they don't say, yes, okay, I'm going to die. But she did give you a project for you two together, and she did put you in charge of protecting her.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of medical, like, you know, you weren't going to go, no, let's send all the blood to Germany. This sounds amazing. She knew you were never going to do that.
Yeah.
So somehow there is that, even though she was in denial, there is another conversation going on.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
And she had compartmentalized conversations, and she knew what bit she could focus on at a time. I think that's very true, yeah. And knowing when she was going to think about the fact that she was dying and when she wasn't in order to function.
In order just to be able to get through that day. Because it's a huge thing to deal with. So when she went into the hospice, you kind of knew, okay, it's definitely happening now. Was she in the hospice for a long time? Or
I think she was in the hospice for 4 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, quite a long time.
Yeah.
The initial reason, the only reason she'd agree to go in initially was for respite care.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, Mum, you won't be leaving home forever. We can just pop into this hospice.
I know.
And they are funny places, hospices, I think, because they do that. I mean, they're wonderful and so grateful for them. And that's a real statement, like, small and large human kindnesses just mean the world to you, don't they? And
oh my God,
I think hospices are a very grand kindness, and that's so important. But that process, they kind of, you have that, again, that relationship between them kind of going like, oh, we're not a morbid place. We're not a place for dying. And you're kind of like, what the fuck is going on? Where is everyone going?
Just gone outside, guys.
I was like, and so that very, you're almost on the stage with her of being like, you're dying, like fucking screaming it. And a point of everyone being like, oh, it's very baby steps towards that point.
Having a lovely little time.
We're
just going to have the windows open today. And but then
but that lightness, I suppose, is so necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm obsessed with this, of like how similar death and birth are. And it's the same thing, like when you're like really, I mean, I was like really late, and they're like, why don't you just pop in? We'll just have a look at you, pop in. And then you're there like, why don't we just induce you? And you're like, okay. And they're like, don't we just put you on the ward with it? It's all right. And you are sort of led in the same way because you're very vulnerable and you're scared.
Yeah.
And there's all these people going, no, we're just going to pop in and don't you worry. And then you're like, I seem to be in labour. And they're like, yes, we knew that. That's what we were hoping would happen. Yeah, I know. And they obviously, my mum's friend is a hospice nurse and she's great to talk to because she like is very blunt about stuff. But she said once that, she was like, yeah, I can look and see sometimes how long they've got because I've seen so many people die.
Yeah.
And I think she's like, you know, the family can't see that. But that's the job of that's my job is to go, oh, this person's got not very long, actually. So we better get them in the room. Let's make sure the family, we've got all the numbers. You know, like that's their job, which is, it's kind of incredible when you, it's one of those things, that service you don't think about till you need it. Exactly the same time your baby, until you need it, it's like, oh, sure.
Some it's kind of like everyone's an NHS patient, they just haven't checked in yet.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
Were you around your dad then?
Yes, So I always get this wrong. I always say he was in a hospice. My mum always rings me after the podcast.
I think I've listened before when you said he was in a...
He was in a hospital.
Right.
This is the first time I've admitted it. I really thought it was a hospice, but she was like, no, he never got to the bloody hospice. He was in a... I mean, it was a cancer wing at the hospital. He was supposed to go into the hospice, but then he got too sick to get moved. So, but I mean, in all extensive purposes, it kind of was. People weren't really coming out of there. Yeah. So it was a very, in my memory, it's like, it looked very, it's, you know, they had a little garden and it was very separate and there were all the palliative care ward.
Okay.
So it wasn't a hospice. I completely, again, memory, I just conflated that. And then my mum said to me the other day, no, didn't get, I was like, oh, where was he then? Hospital. So he was in but we were all there. Yeah, we were all there at the end. Were you guys there when she died?
Yeah.
What happened?
Whenever anyone asks me this question, I always want to make a joke out of it.
It's totally fine.
And every time I've tried to, it's just not funny at all. And I'm just not...
you're only 18 months in, so those jokes are still a little raw.
I always kind of go like, I just wish I hadn't learned that motorbike or something. And then I go, ha, 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 ha. It just looks like I'm like absolutely having a breakdown.
It is because you're in the early days.
It is
in about 4 years' time, you'll get like a good gag out of it. But like,
I am writing a show about it, but we'll see. So, I mean, I was there. On the morning, we used to do it in shifts and I was there. It was very close to just after Christmas, 3 days after Christmas.
Oh,
and I was there in the morning about 8 and she couldn't sit up and she just said, tell everyone I can't sit up.
Wow.
And that was just her saying, I think, let everyone know that I'm gonna die.
God, that's kind of amazing that she had that, like, that much self-awareness.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, she was always very, very sensitive to her body. She was always very sensitive to her body, and she's always like, oh, I'm very tired, or I'm very blah. And I think she might have had cancer for a very long time.
Mm.
And it's hard to know where she got it from, but there's a lot of controversy. The place that she grew up in, Newport, was a very poor area that was associated with toxic dumps and all that.
So it could
have been something. But back to the day, and then I just called my family. We were in York in St. Leonard's Hospice in York, and I called my twin sister, my dad, and his partner Scott, and we all just came in. She died at 2 o'clock that afternoon.
Wow.
Which was very... Actually, what happened was my sister was sat facing my mum, and we were all in the room as she was dying, and very sibling thing to kind of do. I was like, I want some attention from mum. And Amy was like, I want some attention from mum. And it's like, I mean,
amazing.
A more acute expression of that. And so Amy was really, I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but Amy was obviously upset, and my mum was lying down and Amy was there holding her hand. And I was like, I want to hold mum's hand.
As only twins do.
She's got more than me. And so I was like, oh, you know, to pacify the situation, I was like, oh, Amy, should we go for a walk? Because I kind of wanted to check in with Amy as well. So we were kind of on the same page rather than being twins. And so we left the room and went for a walk. And oh, my sister's then boyfriend, a partner, Rick, ex-partner Rick, was there, who was lovely. And he, we were out in the hospice and he came running out and was like, come. And so me and my sister actually, we were sat there the whole day, but we left the room for the moment that she died, which I think when you talk to palliative care nurses, or they say it's very common, you can sit by someone for 10 years and then you go to the loo and then the person lets go.
But also, having done this show so much, I've heard that story so many times, and I think, I've got no qualifications, so welcome to this is the mild-mannered Canadian coming back to you. I can't help but wonder if a parent goes, you didn't have to see it. I waited till you left the room.
Yeah, I think
because you're my
that.
Children. Yeah. And I think as a child, you're like, no, I want to be there. But I think as now I'm a mother, a very new mother, it's a very different thing of like, I can understand being like, yeah, I waited and now they're gone. They don't get to see, they don't have to be for that moment.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've heard that so many times of the child leaving the room and then being like, oh, how comes it happened when I left the room? And it's like, yeah, maybe they didn't want you to have to see that. I don't know.
I have
no qualifications.
I think sometimes when it comes to that, I think that just comes through, that's something you know through experience, as you said, with nurses, just knowing the routine of death. There does seem to be something there where it's difficult to let go when you're in the presence
of your children. Of course. So then you came back and
I came back and she died. And then we all had some moments with the body.
Yeah.
And that felt really good, actually. Mm. That felt just really powerful. I just felt really kind of in tune with the kind of values and things that she'd given me. And it felt very energizing being with her at that point.
Yeah.
And then I left and I think ate a massive fish and chips and about 3 packets of Quiet Street. And
fair play.
And I think really went through stages after that of feeling kind of really energized by my mum, and also that free time. Well, you don't have it because you have to organize the funeral, but just feeling absolutely overwhelmed by it, like you've got a kind of chest full of lead.
But it's funny, like that time thing, because when someone has been ill and it's so consuming.
Yeah.
And I remember, obviously I was 15, but that sort of felt that kind of like almost summer holidays of like that weird way of like, oh, there's nothing. It's just clear for a bit, isn't it?
And you're still alive.
Yeah, and you're still alive.
You've gone through this almost process of dying.
Yeah, you've been dying with them.
Where you're like, okay. Also as well, I think just as, you know, a relatively young person or early middle-aged, however you want to view it. But you're just a lot of time just sat in the corner of a room with my mum. And when she had her blood transfusions every week, she used to often want someone to go with her. So you just sit in the corner for 12 hours. So that feeling of just being like flaccid and like unutilized, and then suddenly you've got this kind of oof. And
well, it's like life again.
It's life again.
And you sort of think, yeah, oh my God, I can move and I can run and I can laugh and I can. And it's horrible because you realise it's only so highlighted because you know they can't.
Yeah.
But also, there is a joy in that of like, oh, I can breathe. I can do that. Which I think is just a very human reaction to death of like, it's like your soul being like, don't forget you can breathe.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, it's easy to stay in that state, I think. I definitely remember feeling that being young of that state being quite like a comfy sofa sort of sucks you in a little bit. And then I think because when you are younger, you sort of, when you come out, you're like, I don't want to do
that. Yeah, that's a
really
good way of putting it. It feels squishy and kind of like heavy. And and I think there's that part of you that you have to accept that there's a huge part of you that does not want them to die. There's another part of you that once you know they're going to die, it's just like, can we just fucking do this? And that, I think, can make you feel, I think, very guilty and all those other things. But having ownership over that, being honest about what you then have again.
Of course, and of course you want, because you just want this to be, because it is the most limboic situation. And again, like birth, you know, when you go into labour, you're like, I just want this done. Like, why is this taking so long? And it takes a long time to have a baby, and it takes well, sometimes, but it takes a while to die. Like that process, people don't, unless something, you know, sort of a tragic accident happens. When it is an illness in the body doesn't just sort of, it takes its time, I think, especially with cancer. That's what I've noticed anyway. It's like, it's got to go through the whole body and affect everything. And it just, it's a slow process.
Yeah.
But of course you want it over because you love them and they're in pain and it's shit. And there's a small bit of your brain of like, well, if this just stopped, then...
Yeah, although then people sometimes go to you, oh, well, at least they're not in pain now. And you're like, ha, I want to throw you away. But but that's very true, that just all-encompassingness of it that you feel is never going to end in uncertainty.
And you're allowed to say it. That's the thing. Yeah, like when someone else says it to you, like, how do you know if they were in pain? Or like, you weren't there for those, you weren't there for those 12-hour blood transfusions. Like, it's such a weird, it is both those things at exactly the same time. It's wanting them to live and wanting them to be not in this situation. They exist together completely. And I think you're right. The ownership is really important. Otherwise, you feel so guilty over something you did feel, rather than going, everybody feels like that. It's fine. Like, it's okay. You know, it's all right. So do you remember the days afterwards? Was it a bit of a blur? Like, did you have to go back to work or anything?
I didn't. I was quite fortunate in that, obviously, all us comedians are freelance.
That's handy, isn't it?
I'm in-house for, for Network Rail. So I suppose... I made a decision just to do enough work to survive financially rather than push things forward so I could take the time. But actually that was also very difficult because it meant that I did have the time to be totally encompassed in it, which is good because I look back and I know that I was there as much as I there for a lot of it, and I don't feel like I missed out on moments with her or anything like that. But it had a bigger impact on my life.
Yes. Yeah, that's it's I can, you know, there's whatever way you do it is the right way, but I can see that doing it like that is tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but you do get those moments.
Yeah.
My husband did that with his mum. He sort of stopped working and really cared for her.
Really?
Yeah, and it was really...
How long was she?
She was ill for about a year and a half, I think. Yeah, similar, and cancer, and again, quite rare form. That people sort of used to get excited about, which that was another, like, doctors would be like, ooh, and you'd be like, okay, guys, can you chill a little bit? Like, bring it in, because we're not feeling the excitement about it at the moment. But yeah, I remember that. I remember thinking it's like he's watching a really intense film, because I reduce everything to narrative. So it's like, if you watched it in bits, it's easier, but it takes longer. But he did the, you know, he went and sat at the BFI for the 9 hours film and did the whole thing. And you're like, whew.
The treble Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Director's cut.
Yeah.
But it does take it out of you. Of course it does. Of course, because you've been through something so intense.
Yeah.
And there hasn't been, like, people who have, you know, inverted commas, normal jobs then go back to work and there's that distraction. But I think when you are freelance, it's, you sort of then go back home and there isn't. Normality, is there?
No, and you have to start the engine again. I think freelance life or comedy like that is just so much about momentum. And you then have to bring that back. Which I think for me it was, at the funeral is then this horrible, this the morbid grotesqueness of having conversations with people about, should we bring your mother's body in through the left or the right kind of thing? And you're like, oh, I'm spinning in, okay, and bye, and it's just difficult. So I think once we got past that, but the funeral felt very, very energising because it's very intimate. She wasn't in a coffin. She was wrapped in her own fabrics.
Wow.
So she was very there.
Oh,
was
my,
like,
God.
My mum.
So did she ask for that?
Yeah. She mentioned it. She kind of said, do what you like, but she wouldn't have wanted an austere coffin.
Yeah,
and she was
always
not really wanting to kind of reinvent or contradict traditions a bit. And she loved those fabrics.
Wow.
And she loved those shawls, and so and the funeral directors could do it, you know.
Wow.
So it was very intimate. And
was it a cremation or?
No, she was buried.
She was buried. And was it a religious ceremony or?
It was the person who, what's the term, hosted it? MC.
I was about to say MC.
Flibbidi-bidi-bidi-dip.
I was like, that is not the right word.
Ladies and gentlemen.
The
the DJ, the guy in the dress. He is Church of England, but it was a non-religious ceremony. Right, he was a friend. And we kind of designed it ourselves. Our cousins, Johan and Jams, who are very Welsh.
Johan and Jams.
And Johan and Eisteddfod are incredible musicians, so they played and I actually sang, which I don't normally do. Which now I think back at that and I hope it was fine, or everyone's going, well, he really is taking the loss of his mother badly. And they go, we're going to have to applaud.
Very good.
Very good, as he sings a really out of key version of, like, I will always love you. That isn't what I sang. I sang a folk song.
What folk song did you sing?
I sang Wild Mountain Time. Because my mum used to want to go. She was a very strange mix of things. She was a scientist, a feminist, but then, yeah, also into nature and crystals and all those kind of things. And she used to really, we used to go to folk clubs together a lot, and she always used to encourage me to sing because I've got about 2 songs I can do. And so I used to do that with her, so it was a song that reminded me of her. Really.
That's lovely.
I hope it was.
It was, it sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Wow, so you really made the funeral.
Yeah.
Like as individual as she was by the sound of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did that feel really important to you?
It felt hugely important. Mm. And actually, I think I felt like I was in control of something. Also, speaking as well, it's like, okay, this is kind of my job. I know how to do this and I have control here. That's what kind of encouraged me to feel like I'd actually be okay with talking about her in a public way, is a way of having ownership and understanding over it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so it did feel good.
And how were you and your sister? Did you sort of grieve together, or was it very like you were like on different paths?
Well, let's think about that. So I think we all had different approaches. I think when my mum was diagnosed, my sister was, if I talked about hospice or anything like that, my sister was like, you do not, mum is not going to die.
Okay.
And my sister was fiercely loyal, I think, to my mum's way of thinking, which was, I'm not, it's not happening. And I actually, it's interesting, I actually had psychotherapy, I had psychoanalysis whilst my mum was dying.
Wow.
Which, and a bit of bereavement counselling, or pre-bereavement counselling, as they called it. And my mum would be like, what's the name of your counselling? And I'd be like, cancer counselling. So I think pre-bereavement counselling is this ominous name.
Yeah, that is not, PBC? Yeah, I don't know what it stands for.
It's like, what's the news, doctor? If you'd like to step into the bereavement room. It was a bit like that.
Yeah. Good on you for going to do it, though. I think that's...
Psychoanalysis, whilst my mum was intense.
Yeah.
Because that's quite analytical and cold and all about your mother, kind of, anyway. Yeah. So it's a bit like, But what that did do, I think, is... And it's interesting, the processes you go through, because I think that did allow me to have more of a separation from my mum, or look to an alternate... My mum was so strong in her views, it was about adjusting to be able to listen to someone else and trust someone else.
Yeah.
And so I think with my sister, my sister remained very loyal to my mum's way of thinking for a little bit longer. And I think almost to try and survive, had to dissent a bit and separate and... try and feel like, oh, I'm going to have to go to someone else for advice, and or not the therapist give you advice, or have ownership over my own thinking, because my mum is not going to be there. So maybe we had slightly different approaches, but it's such an incubator, like intense pressure cooker, isn't it?
Oh, like, it's just, it's like, insane, because there's just all this emotion, and then, like you said, the anger that can't go anywhere. You're angry with somebody for something they didn't choose to do, and so, and then when they're gone, you can't. They're not even there to shout at. Like, so it's just, it's something you just have to go through. Unfortunately, it's really, it's shit. Like that bit when you're in it, it's just shit. But you just have to, gotta go through it. And I mean, I have this terrible metaphor. It's like, it's a bit like your first Edinburgh. You just got to do it. No one can protect you from it. No one can make it better. No one can, oh, don't worry, I'm going to give you this flyer and this venue. No, you just got to do it, mate.
Yeah.
And it will be fucking horrible, but you'll come through the other side and you'll think, oh, that's okay, I learned lots.
You read your grief reviews from Fringe Frog or whatever.
Four coffins?
Yeah.
What? Out of 10.
Reads like a 5 coffee. Yeah.
And so now you are doing a show about your mum. Is that right?
Kinda.
Or is it about grief more?
What I've tried to do with it is just tell the story of the last 3 years of that within the context of my relationship with my mum. So it's about my relationship with my mum, and her death is in there. The show wasn't kind of intended to be about her, actually, but she was in a previous incarnation of the show. And I just kind of felt like I was going, oh, yeah, my mum died anyway, blah, blah, blah. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, I can't actually mention this in the show without giving it
context
and that relationship.
I get very cross, obviously, when people are like, if I'm in a show and they go, oh, my dad died anyway, I'm like, what? No, that's the show. Tell me what happened. Like,
that's
too big. You have to kind of, give space to it. How have you found writing about it? Has it been hard?
Yes. It's been hugely difficult. It's been really good. Mm. I mean, the process, the first time I did it, as you always do with like the first incarnation of an Edinburgh show, it's like, it's often the time when the most people come because I haven't done anything for ages.
Yeah, of course.
And it's the time when the show is unbelievably shit.
It's
like, is he all right? So the first time I did it,
he's singing, guys.
It's like he's doing that thing again. I think he thinks it's good. Clap. He's lost his mother. Clap.
Great. Cool.
Nice,
we got to go.
Mate. Cool. Yeah. Really good. It's very brave.
It's very brave.
So brave of you. It's like, okay.
What every performer wants to do.
So the first one was very much like, you know, jumping off a cliff and seeing if you can fly. So that was difficult. That first bit of it is harder. But as the show becomes more something that can exist externally and I don't have to rewrite.
Yes.
Then it, and actually I love performing it. Performing it feels really cathartic, really great. Rehearsing it by myself, like every time before I do a show, if I've got to kind of think through it, then that bit's really difficult.
Yeah.
That bit feels really thick and dense. But the process of like doing it in front of people feels great. And it's almost that process of like, you fuckers have to listen to me. If you leave, it's really awkward.
So bye, my mom died.
Yeah,
guys.
This is a hostage situation. Let's do it. Yeah.
I think it's interesting, though, because, you know, we are performers. That's how we process stuff.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm the same with any show. Rehearsing it, thinking about it beforehand is like, oh my
yeah,
God.
I think it's that.
Like, what have I done? I hate my bones. I hate my face and my muscles. And then as soon as in front of audience, I'm like, ta-da!
Yeah.
I just feel like, oh, yes, this is what I need an audience to understand my emotional well-being. Like,
yeah.
But that's just who we are. You know, some people need to go and sit quietly in a room. Other people need other people to join them quietly.
Yes, exactly.
So I think that makes, perfect sense. Are any of your family, like, are they okay with you doing a show about it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing that's, the thing that's quite difficult is that my mum and dad, as you kind of can tell, had quite unconventional relationship and unconventional politics. And someone dying, almost in some ways, can be an opportunity to find out lots of things about them you almost didn't know because you, like, rummage through their personal stuff, which I wouldn't do if my mum was alive. Be like, hi, mum, I'm just going to go through your drawers and read your old personal letters. But when someone's died, you do that. So, so it's been a process of discovery, and I think I'm trying to be able to talk about that while still trying to be loyal to my mum and my dad, who had, you know, who's also involved in it and is still here and was very caring and brilliant, and my dad's partner, Scott, and my sister. So there's that question of loyalty. I mean, I did have a feeling that the show isn't for them.
I'd
like them to see it, but it's to tell the story of my family to other people in order to have ownership over it and obviously make it entertaining. But it's permission, I suppose, in comedy is the key, really. If you can find out what your authentic story is and what you have permission to tell. So
yeah, definitely. God, that's such a good way of putting it. Like the things that you do feel like, no, this is my story, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
This bit is.
Yeah.
Sure, you can have that bit.
Yeah, exactly.
This bit's definitely mine.
Yeah.
So have you found stuff out about her or, like, from the old clear out? Like, everybody always finds shit at the clear out.
I found out a lot. Well, so we found out that she'd tried to have children before me, which I didn't realise, before me and my sister. We found that from a letter. My mum's sexuality was always confusing to me.
Mm.
I think she she definitely identified as gay for a long time in the 70s and 80s, but I think that was more as a political position. And I was always, but she obviously was with my dad, who is also gay, so they got together to have children.
Wow.
So in my mum dying, it's opened up these questions that I've almost in some ways been able to talk about more openly. Like, yeah. I wouldn't be able to have this conversation with you, I think, if my mum was alive, because I feel like I was talking about stuff that she might find embarrassing or and I think a few things changed. My mum died, and I understood that in the context of me growing up, I think even in the 90s in Yorkshire where we were, you know, being gay wasn't something that was all, there was still a lot of homophobia around, so there's a lot of secretiveness about that. And so that's been discovered incrementally for me as I've got older. But her dying has been a big shift in the family dynamic, because it meant that my dad's partner, Scott, who I hadn't met until my mum got sick.
Oh, wow.
My mum wasn't actually, my mum and dad weren't on great terms when she got diagnosed. And then, well, they always loved each other, but at that particular moment. And then when that happened, they cared for, well, the main carers for my mum with my sister.
Wow.
So they, her being ill enabled another family dynamic to open that I'm really grateful for. So it's a very, it's a confusing thing, because there is a huge amount of positivity that process of caring for her and has given some love and new additions to the family that are so special. And I now have my dad and Scott.
Yeah.
And so there's and so it opened up things, and it changed things hugely in terms of the family dynamic.
It's so hard, because this is the thing, I just think there's no consequence, there's no action that is ever all bad or all good.
Yeah.
And there's this very, I come back to birth because it just happened. So now when we talk about birth, there's this really big movement of like, you know, it's okay if you're not happy, it's all right. If this is difficult, like, it's not, you know, but for years it was like, you've had a baby, smile.
Yeah.
What the fuck's wrong with you? And now we're like, no, that's, you know, absolutely, there's this other side to it. And I think hopefully we are moving towards, but it's still difficult, of like, when someone dies, it isn't just, this is the worst thing, end of story. Stuff happens.
Yeah.
Like you said, dynamics open and change, and people come in and they show great kindness.
Yeah.
That, and people are vulnerable and allow people to give them that kindness, and of course the positive stuff comes out of that, but it's like, it gets wrapped up in the guilt of like, oh, am I saying I'm glad? Like, it's like, no, you're not. It's just a thing happened and there were consequences to that thing that weren't, that nothing is binary, I guess, isn't it? Nothing's like, that is bad and that is good.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it's awful that she died, but good things come out of those situations.
Exactly. And do you have a feeling of that with your
On my dad? Oh my god! Definitely.
The impact that you feel like, actually, I'm.
Yeah, like, I think it fundamentally changed me as a person. My dad dying when he did, and it would have changed me, you know, whatever age. It fundamentally changed who I was, how I saw the world, and how I communicated with people. And that wasn't always a good thing.
Mm.
Like, you know, I'm superbly intense and honest, which not everybody is down with, but that's who I became, and that I'm glad of that. I'm glad of where I am. So it doesn't take away the sadness that someone's not there. I think that's the thing, is when admitting these two things exist at the same time. Like, you know, I had a baby. I am sad that my dad doesn't get to see that baby and be a grandfather.
Yeah, the children thing, I think, is like,
it's really hard. It's heartbreaking. It is, but exactly the same. You know, I'm making like a circle, like exactly the same part of that feeling is also going, but I wouldn't be the mum I was if he hadn't died.
Yeah.
I wouldn't appreciate those things. I wouldn't, you know, be so happy that she has a great relationship with her dad and want that to be there. And so it's, I don't know, like, it's just life.
Yeah.
It's like everything's so chaotic. And that's the thing, whenever we try and put logic on anything, there isn't really a lot of logic you can apply to any of it. So I do see the positive side to it.
Yeah. And I think that it's been funny, since talking about it on stage, a few people come up to me afterwards, and I met someone the other day and they just went, you know, dead parents club, like, and she was like, I'll do that, and it's never not worked. And you do, I think, in that crisis, I think it does encourage a reflection that gives a depth and that doesn't always
but
can give a depth and sensitivity to people that you really appreciate.
Oh,
like,
my God,
you're like,
yeah.
Oh, fuck, yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about your mum, Anne.
Thank you very much, Garrett. Enjoyed it.
You can follow Robin on Twitter at rcliffan, and you can see his show, The Sea Is Big Enough to Take It, at 8 p.m. on Bob's Blunderbuss every day at the Edinburgh Fringe this year. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, or email us thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.